Hi, we're back. Dominic Arkwright here with Health Today Radio, an hour of news, views and music to help you get well and stay well. We're talking about everything to do with our health, our lifestyle and our health service. Today, the actress Eleanor Crawley on managing type 1 diabetes alongside a busy TV and film career.
If you're on set and you're on location and, you know, somebody's somewhere on set in the hundreds of people has got your sugar tester, it's quite hard to locate that person when you're about to go for a take or, you know, it does take a lot of focus.
Stammering, how much do we really understand about it and what help's available?
It was the first thing I thought about every morning. And, you know, when you blow your birthday candles out, when you make a wish or see a shooting star or anything, it was always the wish and I just wanted it magically to go away.
And how come I'm fat and you're not? The role of genes in obesity.
The way these obesity genes work is they modify our appetite. They make us more likely to respond to the presence of food by fancying it, and they make us less likely to feel full after actually we've really had quite enough.
Most of us will know, or at least know of, a child who stammers. Maybe you were one of them. One in 20 children under 5 are thought to go through a phase of stammering. It doesn't usually last into adulthood, but around 1 in 100 adults are estimated to be affected, more men than women as it happens. We spoke to Katie Bailey, who's stammered since early childhood. She told Rosie Runciman about the impact it's had on her life.
I noticed it as a problem when I went to school. And I think I'd been stammering for a couple of years before that, but it started to be something I felt scared about and I thought was wrong. And I don't even know how I knew that, but I knew that I really, really didn't want to do it. And I wanted to push my words out instead of feeling stuck. So it was a really big problem to me by the time I was 6 or 7. I felt very, very, very worried about my speech.
And was there help available at that age?
When I was at primary school, I was asked to come out and meet up with a lady. And we used to do looking at pictures and talking. I didn't feel very happy about that. I was pulled out of my class and I felt a bit like there was something wrong with me. And it's interesting because I don't know if my parents knew, but I didn't tell my parents that I was going to see this lady at school. And so somehow I felt ashamed about that as well.
So did you discuss stammering with your parents
at
that age?
No, it wasn't talked about. And it was the elephant in the room, really, because I had quite a violent stammer even at an early age. I was very, my stammering was characterised by blocks, but very long blocks, and in which I would get et into blocks like that that could go on for 30 seconds, and I was exhausted and gasping for breath, and my head would be thrashing around as well. I'm sure my parents were talking about it and wanting to do the best for me, but it somehow or other, it didn't feel like it was something up for discussion. And I think that's something that's really, really changed now, partly because stammering is a bit more talked about in general, but also I think because of the speech therapy that's available now for young children, where it is looking at the family as a whole.
So apart from being taken out of the class,
yeah,
which you didn't like,
yeah,
what other help was available when you were
so
little?
I think it was then quite a long time, and it was when I was a young teenager. So when I'd gone to high school, stammering was a really, really big problem for me. It was the first thing I thought about every morning. And, you know, when you blow your birthday candles out, when you make a wish or see a shooting star or anything, it was always the wish, and I just wanted it magically to go away. Really, really wanted it to go away. And it would be the first thing I would think about when I did any new thing. For example, going to school on the bus was a torment. You know, people would think of questions to shout out at me to try and get me to speak and respond like that. And the register was terrible. And I'm not sure if they still do a lot of reading out in class, but I, in my school, used to do that. And I would work out which paragraph I was counterhead, which paragraph am I going to get, practice the words, and, you know, so I didn't actually take in whatever book it was, or because I was just worried about whether the words would come out, whether I'd be able to answer the questions or not. So it was a really big problem, and at this point I sort of plucked up courage really to mention it to my parents, at which point loads and loads of really good stuff started to happen.
So you finally discussed it with your parents, and then what happened?
Then I think, well, absolutely the best things happened, because I got put in touch with some really, really good therapy. As part of my journey as somebody who stammers, it actually involved some therapy which, looking back on it, wasn't particularly helpful because it was very focused on being fluent. And I suppose looking back with the advantage of hindsight, what I've really, really found so liberating now is recognising that it's not about being fluent, it's about how you feel and whether you dare to speak and live life to the full. It did come a bit unravelled when I discovered that although I could speak fluently using my technique, actually I felt just as scared as I had before, and in some ways more scared. All that happened is my speech became even more of a performance, and it was actually very, very perfect, and all my, you know, everybody around me, my therapists and my parents and family were really, really impressed. And so my fear of falling, my fear of stumbling, of stammering, actually got worse.
Because so you spoke less?
I think it made me see that there's more to stammering than your fluency. And I think a lot of people who seek out speech therapy, obviously it feels like you've got something wrong that you can't do. So therefore, the obvious answer is to speak fluently. And it can seem like that's a no-brainer. But once you start looking a bit more closely at it and think, well, what is it that's actually a problem? It's that fear of talking, it's that anticipation, it's thinking that people will laugh, it's the struggle, and it's how much, what kind of knots do you tie yourself up in, that's the real problem. So working with a therapist more holistically to look at that, rather than the therapist going along and thinking, oh yeah, well, it's just a matter of being fluent, because it is more than that. So the most recent therapy I've had, which has been really, really life-changing, has been looking more deeply at that acceptance side of it. That's a therapy which really feels like it's completed the circle for me, and now I can feel like I accept my stammer, but also I can, it's enabled me to now go into lines of work where I talk for a living, so it's no longer holding me back.
Katie Bailey, now very comfortable about her stammer. Now let's go to the Stammering Support Centre in Leeds, one of only a few centres in the country, I suppose, not surprisingly, to offer specialist services for stammerers of all ages. Dr. Hilary Liddell is the clinical lead there. Rosie asked her first about the scale of the problem.
Roughly 750,000. It's 1% of adults stammer and approximately 5% of preschool children. Most preschoolers who start stammering will stop stammering, but by adulthood, it's 1% of the population stammers.
So are you born with it? What causes it?
You're not really born with it. You're born with a predisposition towards stammering, and there seems to be a strong genetic component, so it often runs in families. But a child wouldn't typically start stammering until just under the age of 3. Kids start to talk round about the age of 12 months, but it seems to be as their language development accelerates and maybe they're stringing more words together in a sentence, that seems to be the time that they tend to start stammering.
So why do people stammer? What's going on when they... What's happening?
OK, stammering is interruptions in the forward flow of speech, so that might take the form of repetition. So a young child might repeat whole words. So they might do something like and. People can repeat parts of words. So that would be my. They might repeat phrases. They might also prolong sounds or stretch them. That would be like that. And sometimes people block, so that might be they get completely stuck. So it might be something like that. So there might be a silence there, or they might fill the block with some other sound.
Do we know why it happens?
Well, there's a neurological component to it, and the underlying cause of that is often genetic.
People get referred to come and see you, and then what can you do with them?
It depends on the age of the person, and every person who stammers is different, so the therapy that they would receive would be tailored to them. So with very young children, we'd be working only through the parents. At an early stage, the children may not even know that they stammer themselves. So we might use some indirect therapy. So there may be things that the parents can change about the way they're communicating with the child that might help the child to speak more easily. And as the child gets older and becomes more aware, then you might work more directly with the child themselves. And that would either be on an individual basis or in group therapy. And the same with adults. We see them individually or in groups. Stammering does not need to stop people having good communication skills. And I know people who stammer that give presentations to hundreds of people and they do it brilliantly. And that's not necessarily fluently. They will stammer, but they will communicate excellently. And I think that's something that's quite surprising to people sometimes.
What sort of a difference can you make sometimes?
Speech therapy can make a huge difference. I can think of examples of people who've been so restricted by the stammering that they would text their wife at home rather than go to speak to them in the house.
Because the effort was too great to speak?
The effort, the shame attached to the stammering, you know, being concerned about what the other person thinks. I mean, this particular client who I'm thinking of, even relating to his family, he would avoid family parties, the things that he really, really wanted to do. But people just thought he was quite antisocial, maybe. And after his first speech therapy session in a group, so he met other people who stammered, he had the confidence to go off and buy himself a cup of coffee in a cafe, and he sat there drinking it, and he looked around, and for the first time he said he felt like a normal person.
What has surprised you the most since you started doing this?
The dramatic changes that people can sometimes make, that they can go from being so restricted and quiet and not wanting to speak because of how they feel about the stammering, and they can go on to give presentations, be excellent public speakers, and being a stammerer does not mean being a poor communicator.
Dr. Hilary Liddle from the Stammering Support Centre in Leeds. You can find more details on the NHS Choices website.
My name is John Omotrading. You're listening to Health Today on the NHS.
Yes, she was on a few weeks ago talking about running in her 60s. You want to hear that again? Search this site and you can. Now, Eleanor Crawley is an actress in her early 20s. She's been working in TV and film since she was 15. You may have seen her as Tiri in the television series Vikings or as Princess Cicely in The White Queen. What you can't tell from Eleanor's screen appearances, though, is that she has type 1 diabetes and manages her condition with an insulin pump. She was diagnosed as diabetic when she was 9 years old. Isabel Eaton went to meet Eleanor at home in Cardiff and asked her how that original diagnosis came about.
It was actually my parents who kind of diagnosed me first, because my mum's mum fostered children. She actually fostered a diabetic child. So they kind of guessed what was going on. I'd got very thin and drinking loads, you know, very, very tired, needed the loo all the time. So they actually took me to the doctor and said, look, we think this is diabetes. And he confirmed that.
And how has it developed in the sense of incorporating the things you need to do into your daily life? Is it easier now?
When I was in school, I think my parents took that on more than I did, if I'm being completely honest. You know, they would remind me to do sugar tests, or when I was on injections, they would, you know, sit me down and talk me through that. Then when I went on the pump, they kind of would work out my insulin ratios and do all the carb counting for me. When I left school, it was almost like a second diagnosis in a way. It was like me learning how to do that and how everything affects it, because it really is affected by everything in life, you know, hormones and what you're doing. And obviously, because my day is never the same, it was a whole new learning curve leaving school. But yeah, I just cope by testing loads all the time, probably more than needed, but it's the only really way you can kind of get your head around it, I think.
So tell me about the testing. Why is it necessary? What do you do? And then how do you manage your diabetes as a result of what you find out?
Well, on the insulin pump, they actually recommend that you test as soon as you wake up and then before any meal and 2 hours after every meal and before you go to bed. Probably end up doing a few more in between, depending on if I'm exercising or, you know, if I'm at work, for example, if I'm going to do something strenuous, or if I know I'm not going to be able to test for a little while because I'm somewhere, you know, on location or something. And depending on what you're doing, you can adjust your insulin then with the pump. So if it's slightly too high, you can give a correction to bring it down. Or if it's slightly too low, you can eat something. Sometimes I let it run a little bit higher if I'm about to do something active.
So that's quite onerous, isn't it? That's something that you've got to be thinking about all the time.
Yeah, and I mean, like everyone, I'm not a robot about it. Sometimes I'll forget to do it for a while if I'm doing something crazy, or especially when I'm working, I have to say, I'm still figuring that one out of how to fit in sugar tests in the day. Because if you're on set and you're on location and, you know, somebody's somewhere on set in the hundreds of people has got your sugar tester, it's quite hard to locate that person when you're about to go for a take, or, you know, it does take a lot of focus. And when I'm particularly busy, that focus does go a little bit.
How do other people respond to your diabetes? Is it something you talk about with your friends, or is it something you tend to keep to yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. All my friends will know about it, and pretty much all of them know it in great detail. My best friend, for example, can usually tell I'm hypo before I know I'm hypo. So they become like little mini diabetes nurses around me. Yeah, I mean, you do get questions when you meet people. Like, a lot of people think the pump is a pager, something like that. You kind of have a little set spiel you do, you know. I'm happy to tell anyone around me about it. It's definitely not an issue if somebody asks. And even now, you know, I'm learning, oh, hang on, you know, I've got high blood sugar, why is that? And then I realise I'm really stressed or something like that is happening. Or, you know, I feel like I'm still learning about it. It's really interesting in a very nerdy way. Literally everything, anything you can think of. So, you know, your hormones, if your hormones are going off on one, that can affect your blood sugar levels, your stress levels. Or a big one for me, if I get anxious about something, then I kind of lose grip on what my blood sugars are doing. Diet, exercise, obviously. Even things like if you're out in the sun for a long time, you know, if it's really hot, or if it's really cold and your body's trying to stay warm, or tiny things that you wouldn't think about can be mystery blood sugar changes.
Eleanor Crawley on managing type 1 diabetes alongside her TV and film career. So how do most people cope with managing their type 1 diabetes in the workplace, and how hard is it? Natasha Marsland is a clinical advisor for Diabetes UK.
Both types of diabetes require a lot of thought, a lot of care, both from the person with diabetes and also the care that you receive from healthcare professionals. So having diabetes, and I'm going to focus on type 1 diabetes here, requires you to think about the food that you're eating, that your insulin, how you're taking the insulin, and also your activity levels, and making you sure that you receive the right checks from your healthcare team.
So you've really got to, once you've been diagnosed, you've really got to start thinking about what you do, the amount of exercise you take, about what you eat, and about the amount of medication that you need.
That's right. It's something, unfortunately, you can never switch off from. It's something you've got to think of day and night, regardless how you feel, what you're doing. You have to think about what you're eating. You have to make sure that you're taking the insulin at the right time and the right dose. And also you need to think about your activity levels. And then also you've got to think about making sure that you get the right care from your healthcare professionals and that you attend your appointments. But saying that, it's no reason, and I'm sure there'll be listeners listening to this that have just been diagnosed or maybe got a child with type 1 diabetes, there's no reason why having type 1 diabetes can prevent you leading a long and successful life that you would have achieved without having the condition. It shouldn't stop you doing anything.
So what are the keys really to making that happen?
What we do know with diabetes is that keeping your blood glucose and your blood pressure well controlled and keeping your weight at the right weight for you can really help reduce the long-term complications of diabetes that are very serious, such as heart disease, blindness, prevalence of amputations. These are all something that you can reduce your chances of developing if you keep your blood pressure and blood glucose well controlled.
Well, let's talk about blood glucose monitoring. What's the point of it?
Blood glucose testing is vital for someone with type 1 diabetes. What we do know with blood glucose control, it can reduce the incidence of the long-term complications of diabetes. So blood glucose monitoring can really tell you what your blood glucose levels are doing on a day-to-day. So it really can keep you sort of like in charge of what's going on, and it can help you spot fluctuations, or if your medication's not right for you, then you can go back to your healthcare team and maybe think about going on to a different insulin or a different insulin regime.
So how often might I need to test?
It can vary. If someone who's pregnant, for example, needs to do testing more often, certainly someone who's unwell needs to test more often. A lorry driver, for example, would need to test more often. So it does vary, but certainly someone with type 1 diabetes would need to do several tests a day. So these blood glucose monitoring is essential for their management of their diabetes.
So I do the test, I get a figure. The point, I guess, is to use the results sensibly. So what should I do?
Well, depending on your results, you may need to adjust your medication. You may need to think about what you've eaten in the past. It may be low. It may show that you're experiencing something called a hypo when your blood glucose levels go too low. So you'll need to take some Lucozade or glucose tablets to get your blood glucose levels up rapidly. So depending on the result, we'll determine what you do as a result. So blood glucose testing really can really empower someone with type 1 diabetes. I'm giving very general advice because the person with diabetes really needs to go to their healthcare advice for the education to so they know what to do depending on their blood glucose results. But I just want to illustrate how powerful glucose testing is, and also the many things people with type 1 diabetes have to think about living day to day with the condition.
The point is to match your action to the result. What happens if you get it wrong? What happens if you inject the wrong amount of insulin, too little or too much?
If you feel you've made an insulin error, it's important that you contact your healthcare team. So do contact your healthcare team immediately and they can advise you accordingly.
Should I be telling my boss? Who needs to know?
You don't actually have to tell your boss, but we would advise you to tell your boss so they can make adjustments accordingly for you. And diabetes, both types of diabetes, are covered by the Disability Discrimination Act, so you are protected. And it makes sense to tell your employers so they can make reasonable adjustments, or the colleague that you're sitting next to, for example, will be aware that if you're starting experience a hypo, they might not realise, if you haven't told them you have diabetes, that your blood glucose levels are low, so they won't know what to do. So we would advise someone to tell their employers, but we realise and acknowledge for a lot of people, especially in the current climate when there are a lot of redundancies and a lot of people find it difficult to find work, this can be difficult to do. And at Diabetes UK, we do have an advocacy team that can support you in this and can offer advice. And we do this on many, many occasions when people are experiencing problems at work.
And the other thing, it seems to me, is that it must be a lot more difficult to plan, for example, holidays, to travel. Talk to me about some of the extra difficulties I may face as a result of having type 1.
Well, it would be a positive. There's no reason why you can't go to all parts of the world. It's just the key is planning, and it's important that you have a health note from your doctor to explaining to the airline, for example, if you're flying, that you have diabetes and why you need to carry your insulin, whether or not it's an insulin pump or pens, for example, and your blood glucose testing kit. It's important to think about the food, making sure you have some appropriate carbohydrate snacks, like crackers, for example, because the airline meals may not contain enough carbohydrate for you. Being careful where you store the insulin, for example, so you're not storing it in the hold so it will freeze. Making sure you have double of supplies in case a supply gets lost, or you have to extend your journey. So there's a lot of planning, and we do have an awful lot of information on our website about this. So planning is key, but this, I want to reassure people, and we have many features in our Balance magazine on our website. People climbing Kilimanjaro with type 1 diabetes, going to the North Pole, for example. There's no reason why you can't go on holiday, but it's just planning and being prepared.
What about holiday insurance? Is that affected?
Yes, it can be, and it is important that you declare your condition to make sure so your insurance is valid. We do advise people to carry a European health card as well, because that should cover you for the basics. But certainly you must make sure you have insurance tailored to your needs.
Natasha Marsland from Diabetes UK. If you want to comment on that or have a story of your own you'd like to share, do contact us. The email is healthtodayradio@nhs.net, and we're on Twitter with the hashtag #HealthToday. OK, we all know that exercise is important for good health, but increasingly the scientific research seems to be suggesting that it's a really important step we can take to improve our chances of staying healthy. A recent study by Cambridge University found that lack of exercise is twice as likely to shorten your life as being seriously overweight. But according to the scientists, a brisk 20-minute walk each day is all it takes to increase your lifespan. Now, I know to some people that sounds a little, to some it may sound a lot. You may not be very fit or very young or just not very keen on the whole idea. But take heart, it doesn't have to be boring. There are lots of ways to make exercise fun. Some people apparently find something called Zumba helpful. I'm not going to explain what that is, but Isabel Eaton went along to the weekly Zumba Gold class at Wells Leisure Centre in Somerset to find out more.
Hello, my name's Rhea and I do the Zumba Gold class. It's specifically for over 50s really, or anybody with injury, so it's a lower impact version of the regular Zumba class. Other way! We do cumbia, we do salsa, a bit of rock and roll, all different really, whatever you can think of.
So is the idea to get your heart rate up? Is it aerobic exercise really?
It is an aerobic exercise, but it's also a gentle exercise, so it is to get the heart rate going and the fitness. It is quite a social, as you can see, it's a very social thing, so people come with their friends or they meet people here, so it is just, it is an exercise class, but it doesn't feel like an exercise class.
And do you have to be a good dancer to do it?
No, not at all. Everybody goes different directions and everything. As long as you keep moving, that's all you need to do, really.
I'm Miranda Spenlove-Brown, and I come to Zumba Gold as often as I can, fairly regularly. I enjoy the movement and the music. The music particularly is great fun. Movement, it boosts one's flexibility, and it's much more enjoyable than the gym. And I would recommend it to people for the sheer enjoyment and fun it gives.
I'm Joelle. And I retired a year ago, so I decided to join the leisure centre and Zumba in particular. I enjoy it because the music is uplifting and you always have a smile on your face. And yes, I enjoy it very much.
Hello, I'm Diane. I'm 65 years of age. Went to the doctors for one of the sort of annual health check things. Decided I was putting on a bit of weight and thought it was best to come in and do something about getting a bit more healthy.
It's very easy to get into. You don't need anything to start with, really, apart from a pair of trainers. You can just turn up and go, really. It's a very good way to get into exercise if you haven't done it for a while.
I mean, most of us are 50 plus, and it's a very gentle form of exercise, and you can pitch it at your own level anyway. So yes, definitely the best thing for that sort of age, because it can be very gentle.
I'm Sue, I am 53, and I'm just coming back to doing a bit of exercise after an operation.
And why did you choose Zumba Gold?
You don't have to be as fit to do this, so it's much easier to get going on.
It's exercise with dance, so you're getting exercise, but it's something that's enjoyable at the same time.
Is it hard?
No, not the Zumba Gold. I probably would find the Zumba a bit, it's faster, so I probably would find that a bit harder.
And has it helped you with your weight? Do you feel better for it?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, definitely helps. And definitely helps you feel a lot better. You go away from the class feeling more invigorated.
I notice that there's a lot of people here this morning, but they're all women. Why do you think that is?
I think that is the social thing, because a lot of people come with their friends. I do have men in my other classes. I don't know, I think it's just a dance thing. I think women seem to enjoy the dance more, and their husbands don't want to do salsa with them, so they come here and they can do it on their own.
Okay, chaps, prove them wrong and give Zumba a go. I'm slightly aware we've taken our foot off the pedal in talking about diet in the past couple of weeks, so we're going to correct that now with Jane Wardle, who's Professor of Clinical Psychology at the Health Behaviour Research Centre at University College London. Does she think that some of us are more predisposed to putting on weight than others?
So when we start looking at why one person's heavier than another, it certainly looks as though genetics plays a role. We can show that by looking at family studies. And within families, what you can see is that the closer the genetic association between family members, the more likely they are to have a similar weight. And also, increasingly, we now know some of the actual genes involved, so we can get a gene score for somebody and we can see that that relates to their level of overweight. But I think it's really important that people don't think that this genetic story means that they have no control or there's nothing that can be done or eating is completely irrelevant, because it doesn't mean that. The research which we've been doing here over the past few years, and the same sort of research has been being done in other centres, suggests that the way these obesity genes work is they modify our appetite. They make us more likely to respond to the presence of food by fancying it, and they make us less likely to feel full after actually we've really had quite enough.
There's a genetic thing for saying, ooh, fancy a bit of that, and also for, oh, just one more mouthful. Talk to me about that.
Yes. These two sort of aspects of people's appetite, which we've been studying for many years now, you can see differences within 3 months of birth in children of these sort of appetite traits. You can see it in the way they drink their bottles of milk when they're babies, or even when, how they breastfeed when they're babies. And of course, human beings always were like that. Some of them were very responsive to food and some weren't. There are always some people who easily feel full and some people who don't. The thing is that now, because we live in a world that has so many eating opportunities and so many large serving sizes provided, if you've got these kind of traits, then you're much, much more at risk than you used to be generations ago. There's certainly an issue about people eating relatively unhealthy foods or fatty foods or sugary foods, and of course they'll make it very much easier to overeat or eat more than you need to if you eat those kind of foods. My view is that the crucial thing is the quantity that you eat, and you'll get to a quantity overload a lot more quickly if you eat high fat and high sugar foods. And you'll find it more difficult to get to a quantity overload if you eat high fibre foods and if you eat more vegetables. So obviously the type of food plays a role, but I think it's mostly playing a role because it's affecting the sheer quantity of, if you like, quantity of calories that you're taking in. It's the amount of food which is the key thing that we all need to think of. And I suppose I sometimes even think that we've all been a bit misled. Maybe we've been misleading people a little bit by implying that so long as they eat healthily, there won't be a problem. Because it isn't like that. It's actually quite possible in this modern world where food is tasty to get overweight even if you eat a relatively healthy diet, if you eat too much of it. A problem which has emerged over the past, you know, couple of decades is that people got a lot of messages saying it was important to eat healthily, and they rather took from that, well, as long as I eat healthily, there's no problem, I'm not going to get overweight. But actually, it is possible still to take in too many calories by eating too large a quantity of even healthy food. I mean, some fruits are quite high in calories. If you ate too many of those, you'd easily reach a caloric overload, if you like. It's possible to reach a caloric overload with other healthy foods like porridge or baked potatoes or any of the things which people are encouraged to believe are good for their health. Our research suggests that people often end up eating more than they meant to, mostly because they eat too much at an individual occasion. It's a question of knowing when to stop. So we need to think about when to stop in an individual meal, or how to make sure our meal sizes don't get too big as a part of weight management, sort of going forward for the rest of our lives.
Professor Jane Wardle, remember, if you'd like to share a story with us or comment on anything you've heard, we'd love to hear from you. So email us at healthtodayradio@nhs.net and follow us on Twitter with the hashtag #HealthToday. Now, we've talked about sleep a couple of times in these programmes, partly because I'm a very big fan of it. We've looked at insomnia and, more generally, how to make sure you can get a good night's sleep. You can search back for those in earlier programmes. What we haven't mentioned is sleep apnea, which is more common than I thought. For example, 1 in 25 men aged between 30 and 60 are affected by the condition, which causes you to stop breathing when you're asleep. Our expert is Dr. Michelle Needham, a respiratory physician at Salford Royal Hospital with a particular interest in sleep.
Apnea is our medical term for a breath pause, and sleep apnea is having breath pauses during sleep. We can all have breath pauses during sleep, so we may find that our bed partner might comment that we've held our breath overnight. And sleep apnea syndrome is where we detect on a sleep test that you're having a certain number of breath pauses every hour, and also that that is having consequences to the type and quality of sleep that you have.
So how long do these pauses last?
They can last for a varying amount of time. We have fixed criteria when we're looking for it in terms of a diagnosis.
Which are?
A breath pause for 10 seconds. And that is also has to be associated with a drop in the oxygen level in the blood.
Does it wake you up?
Yes, the brain's a fantastic organ, and the brain will detect that the oxygen level is starting to drift down. And what the brain then does, it wakes itself up out of the deeper sleep. And you may be aware of the wakening if you've been woken to full consciousness. But more common, these breath pauses will wake you just to a lighter sleep. So you may not be aware that there's been anything happening to your sleep at all, but a bed partner might report that you've had a breath pause.
Is it dangerous?
In terms of those individual breath pauses, the brain is fantastic at recovering from that. And I know a lot of people get worried when I say about breath pauses, am I going to start breathing again?
Precisely.
And absolutely you will, because that's the brain's job in controlling all of that. However, we do know that there are some health risks in sleepy people with sleep apnea if it's not treated.
What do you mean by sleepy people?
So if there are feelings that you're waking up the next morning feeling like you've never been to bed, if you're feeling tired in the day, and certainly if you're falling asleep without meaning to in the day.
And is that a consequence of sleep apnea?
It can be. It can be a consequence of poor sleep of any condition. But it's certainly part of the screening questions I would be asking in somebody that I thought might have sleep apnea.
So that is quite worrying if it's affecting people during the day in their job and their daily lives. What can you do about it?
There's various treatments that we can offer. Certainly the number one priority is to have the diagnosis made and picked up. So if somebody is not already under the care of somebody about their sleep apnea, they need to talk to their GP. And
how are they going to know they've got it?
So if a partner reports perhaps that you might be a significant snorer, but at times during the night you go quiet, that sometimes is the signal. Or that a partner may have reported breath pauses. Now, not everybody has a bed partner, so they won't get that witness account. But if you are feeling tired in the morning, like you've never been to bed, if you're falling asleep in the day, then they may be triggers for you to go and seek some help.
And what will the help be?
The help can be varied, and it depends on how severe the sleep apnea is and the consequences of it. So after we do a sleep study on somebody and pick these breath pauses up, we will work together with a plan of action. The action plan may be as simple as some lifestyle changes, and that may be weight loss if somebody's carrying extra weight. Sleep apnea is more common in people who are overweight, but is not exclusively a condition of people that are overweight. Less alcohol. Again, all those things about allowing yourself better sleep sometimes are the only things that we need to do. Other options of treatment are CPAP, and CPAP is a blowing machine treatment at night. That sounds quite severe, but it's a very well tolerated therapy to help with these breath pauses.
What does it do?
So CPAP is a small machine and it blows room air down some tubing to a mask. So at lights out time, the person would put the mask on their face, and by blowing air, that pressure of air keeps all of the air pipe open during sleep. It's not a ventilator, it doesn't control your breathing, you're still breathing normally, but by splinting the air pipe open, it stops those breath pauses, and then the brain can stay in a nice deep sleep rather than be disturbed. Another treatment is a gum shield device, we call a mandibular device, and that is designed to push gently the lower jaw forward during sleep to again splint the air pipe open at the back of the throat, and that's usually more successful in mild sleep apnea rather than the severe end of the spectrum.
Dr. Michelle Needham. One more slice of sleep coming up in the next couple of weeks. We'll talk about sleep walking. What's that and what can you do about it? You may remember we heard the moving story of Sophie a couple of weeks ago, her long battle to turn her life around after years of drug addiction. And she did it thanks to Double Impact, a drug and alcohol recovery charity in Nottingham. When we were there, we met Simon as well. He had his own battles to fight, but like Sophie, he's ended up taking control of his life, as Rosie Runciman found out.
I would say it got problematic about 3 or 4 years ago. I started smoking marijuana as a teenager in the Caribbean where I grew up. And that was pretty ubiquitous. Everybody smoked, and it was a thing I did throughout school. And when I came to England in the 80s, I was a young man. It wasn't something I did every day. It was something I'd do from time to time. And I drank a bit. I wasn't much of a drinker. And that was pretty much what it was like for a long time. I smoked cigarettes, and I'd stopped smoking cigarettes and marijuana for long periods. I spent a lot of time being active, swimming. I was on the swimming team in Guyana. So I'm quite an active person. I swim, I run. It was quite a social thing. I would generally do with mates. We'd have a smoke and a laugh, and it was pretty good fun. When I was in my mid-30s, I ended up working in the catering industry, which is an industry which is completely riddled with drug and alcohol misuse just because of the hours and the events that we're doing. So there's a lot of alcohol runs, obviously a lot of cocaine. Initially in the 90s, it wasn't such a big, it was quite utilitarian. We used it just to stay up. And generally when we weren't working, we were more interested in doing other stuff. I spent a lot of time at music festivals with friends. During the summer, we'd travel around Europe in a van, and it was all about hallucinogenics. So largely mushrooms, all sorts of exotic substances. It was all about the hallucinogenic stuff rather than using sort of uppers, if you will. Started getting myself, I didn't really work properly for a year, did odds and ends. And then I saw an advert for training as a probation officer. So I picked up and got on a probation officer trainee program and did that quite successfully. Ended up working for the probation service for a number of years. But what I noticed, there was a cycle that I seemed to go through with after that, with using drugs, putting them down, managing for a bit, and then it would just kind of just creep back in, usually coinciding with my sort of own discomfort within myself that I kept pointing at relationships. There's, I think the relationships and, my addictive behavior was around not just the substances, but also relationships with women, sex. It all seemed to go hand in hand, and all usually ended up with me feeling quite unhappy, dissatisfied, and then kind of just making a mess of things. It created an emotional blast zone around me, and everybody got affected. My family, my relationships with my siblings, my parents, and Kate, who was the closest to me, she got pretty much, she was really caught in the blast and eventually ended up in us splitting up. Just before we split up, I took a redundancy from probation service. So job structure was gone, the relationship went, and I was by then fully immersed with a bunch of people who were, they were my friends, but they were people I was using with, and it was a very close-knit posse, and I just went into free fall and went through a 2-year period of feeling bad, using drugs to feel better, and it just became a closed circle where, outward appearances, I was still working, I was back in the catering industry again, big mistake, but I was working, I was spending about 6 months here and then going off to the Caribbean, back home, and the intention was to move back to Guyana. So I was coming back in the summer working, going out there for the winters. Even over there, I got into trouble with it. It started to build up over there because I couldn't get hold of the sort of powdered cocaine I was using here. So I started smoking crack over there, which was scary. And I got to a point just before I went, a few months before I got into rehab, before I recognised. I mean, I was beginning to realise I was in trouble, but it was in denial about it.
What was making you realise that actually this was a problem?
The big wake-up call for me was just, I got scared. It kind of dawned on me that I couldn't stop even if I wanted to. And that's the moment that really scared me, because it was really like being possessed by a demon. It's the only way I could put it. Eventually, actually had a lunch with my ex-partner, and I was giving her the usual spiel script about everything being fine. And at the end of it, she just said, well, it's okay, so what's really going on with you? And I just burst into tears and broke down and just told her everything. It was quite a mixed... There was relief and horror mixed in together, because there was a relief of actually just putting it out, but then there was that horror of actually having to look at the past 3 years and what my behaviour had done, what the choices had made, and how it affected everybody, and that wasn't pleasant. But immediately, so my sister and her had obviously been discussing my issues while we were still together, and so she pulled out a leaflet for this place in Nottingham that I was at, Studio House, and she said, well, you know, Penny and I were talking about that, so here. And so I just picked up the phone, phoned them up. A week later, I was in a house full of strangers, telling them stuff that I wouldn't even tell my closest friends. So that was the beginning of the journey to recovery. I confessed everything about what was going on for me. Once I'd got it out, and actually, it's almost that it's like breaking that denial, because the denial has you so strong. And it's almost like speaking out against it breaks it, because once you've let the cat out of the bag, you can lie to yourself a lot, but once you open out and tell somebody else, it's you've broken the power of the denial, because you can't deny it anymore. And I think that was the first step. And I acted quite swiftly. I didn't have time to think about it. I just got on, went out. So I phoned them one day, I got on a train from London and came into Nottingham the next, got assessed, and they offered me a bed in a week. And at that point, I knew that I was going. There was no turning back. I knew I needed help. I haven't looked back since. I just grabbed hold of both hands and turned it around, you know. And
so, how has life changed for you since?
In probably every imaginable way, but mostly internally. I mean, it's the way that I feel, the way that I process my feelings, the way that my relationships with other people are, in those areas, hugely. I mean, I've got less money now than I've ever had, but I feel richer in lots of other ways, because, you know, I used to have a lot of money before and it was never enough. Now I've got very little money and I can manage to squirrel a bit away. My relationships with my siblings is just transformed.
So, are you working?
I am working for the rehab that I was in. So they've offered me some work. I'm sitting with people who have just come in and starting that journey. So that's what I'm doing. So I work there 16 hours a week, but I've also got 2 voluntary jobs. So yeah, I do a lot of voluntary work. I'm quite busy at the moment.
And do you feel happy now?
Yes. I can safely say probably happier than I've felt in years. I found a measure of peace and happiness and fulfillment in life. And it's kind of about finding the magic in the mundane. It's not about having a life, stimulated all the time, but it's a calmer life. And I get a lot of pleasure out of the most simple and mundane things in life. It's been probably the most amazing 12-month period of my whole life. I've done a lot of work and I've learned a lot as well.
Now it's time to take our regular look at what someone does in the NHS to try and understand and appreciate the people who make the NHS tick. We've spoken to a midwife, a sexual health nurse, a matron in A&E, amongst others. Today, Kate Ryan, who's a consultant haematologist at the Manchester Royal Infirmary. She cares for people with blood disorders, in particular sickle cell anemia and thalassemia. She told Isabel Eaton how she came to be interested in this line of work.
I always wanted to be a doctor, right from a very early age. So I was lucky enough to be able to get into medical school in London. I went to St George's and then trained, first of all, in medicine and then decided to go into haematology probably in around the late 1980s. Like a lot of things in medicine, it's what you experience. So I had a couple of jobs as a junior doctor where I just came across some really interesting patients and some very nice consultants, and that sort of inspired me and then became a consultant in haematology in the mid-1990s, based at Central Middlesex Hospital in London. And through being a haematologist there, I came across a lot of patients with sickle cell anemia, and so that fostered my interest. Sickle cell anemia is an inherited blood disorder, and it leads to a problem with the hemoglobin in the red blood cell. And this means that the red blood cell, instead of being a nice disc-shaped round blood cell, becomes crescent-shaped or sickle cell-shaped. And this causes damage to blood vessels, causing blockage of blood vessels, and also anemia. So the condition is very common in various parts of the world. In the UK, this condition probably affects about anywhere between 12,500 and 15,000 people. However, we know because of screening programs that it is actually the commonest severe genetic condition in the UK, with about 375 or so babies being born every year here, and then many others arriving from other parts of the world. So the hallmark of the disease is pain, or the painful crisis, which is episodes of very, very severe pain that can come on very suddenly and can affect any part of the body. And these can be very unpredictable for patients and really is the main issue for them. So by having very severe bouts of pain, they have to have time off school or work. It can make their lives very miserable. There are other complications that we see with sickle, so infection is a big risk. And also for children, there's a high risk of stroke. So sickle cell anemia affects predominantly people of African or African Caribbean origin, although it can be seen in people from parts of southern Mediterranean regions and also the Middle East and India. My working day is very varied, and I think that's one of the nice things about being a doctor is that no one day is the same. So a typical working day would be getting into work. I would check my mountain of emails, and like everybody else, we're consumed by emails these days. I would catch up with one of my specialist nurses or the junior doctor to find out if there's any new patients being admitted or any potentially serious complications going on with any of my patients. Some days I have clinics. Some days I do ward rounds of patients. Sometimes I have meetings with the laboratory staff to go through abnormal results coming through the laboratory. But I also have another role. I'm at the moment clinical lead for the Department of Haematology. So there's a lot of meetings around management type issues, issues about budgets, finances, the way the service is being delivered. But I also have other days when I get involved in more sort of external type things to do with the NHS, to do with sort of more national policies, to do with sickle cell and thalassemia. My daughter said to me, I don't think I'd want to be a doctor because you work too hard. So I think they might have been put off by seeing the hours that I work. I am quite good at trying to keep my work life and my home life separate, but you do take work home. You know, I've always been on call for as long as I can remember at times. So you just accept that sometimes at weekends you're going to get calls about patients. You actually might be in Tesco or somewhere like that, and actually you get a call about a patient, even if you're not expecting it and not on call. So you sort of accept that patients do come into your life. I enjoy seeing and getting to know people over a long period of time. So most of my patients are for life. They come over to my service when they're about 16, and then I carry on looking after them and forever, really. So it's quite nice to see people grow, mature, to see their, you know, how their lives develop. So I enjoy that. I also enjoy being able to participate in influencing the way services are delivered, both locally and nationally, and making sure that sort of standards of care are consistent across the country. At this point in time, a lot of us are very frustrated because we find that we might want to produce a national policy or make things better, but the NHS reorganisation means that nobody knows who to go to get that done. I think when you've been a doctor for a long time, like I have, I think nothing ever surprises you about patients. You see all walks of life. You see some amazing patients who do fantastically well with, you know, despite having been dealt all the wrong cards. And you see also that patients can change. So you might have a patient that seemed very difficult when they were younger, and it's always difficult when you're dealing with the young age group to keep them engaged with their health care and managing themselves. But they do change, people change over life. So I think it is very rewarding at times to support people through difficult times of their life. And then you have some very nice times. You have the times when your sickle patient, you know, is able to get through a pregnancy and start a family.
Dr. Kate Ryan, consultant haematologist at the Manchester Royal Infirmary. Finally, our thank you. On Health Today Radio, we offer the chance to say a personal thank you to people who've helped us to cope with illness or injury. Here's Simon, who's got his life and self-respect back after years of being a drug addict, with his thank you.
I mean, there's loads of people I can start to thank. Obviously, my family, they've been there throughout, and they've been a sort of the ground beneath my feet. But I'd really like to thank Studio House, all the staff there, all the people who journeyed with me in the last 12 months, particularly because without that rehab, without the staff there, without the peers that travelled with me, I wouldn't be here today, so if I can put a thank you out, it would be to them.
That's it for this week. Remember, you can hear most of these interviews on the relevant pages on the NHS Choices website, and we're always keen to hear from you, so email us on healthtodayradio@nhs.net, and you can find us on Twitter with the hashtag #HealthToday. Next week, stress at work. We have lots of information and advice for you about that. A leading cardiologist gives us chapter and verse on our cholesterol levels. And if you thought tiny babies couldn't have mental health problems, you're wrong. We speak to one of the pioneers in this area. This is Health Today. I'm Dominic Arkwright. Thank you for listening. Stay well.
The opinions expressed in this programme are the individual's own personal opinion and do not reflect the views or official policy of the Department of Health or NHS Choices. This programme was clinically reviewed in December 2014.